Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Delighted to be joined in studio today by author Ronan Hessian. We first met Ronan on the show when his debut novel, Leonard and Hungry Paul, became a huge hit in Irish libraries. Ronan's third novel is out now. It's called Ghost Mountain. Congratulations, Ronan.
Thanks very much, Ray, and thanks for having me. Lovely to talk to you again.
I really enjoyed it. Really, really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I'm recommending it already.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Because you don't do that all the time. You have to be careful about recommending books because it takes a good chunk of a person's time, doesn't it?
It does. Like, I think I calculated that your average book takes about 8 or 10 hours to read. And like, if you were to say to somebody, please spend 8 or 10 hours in my friend's company, there's a lot riding on that. So it is a cautious thing, and you don't know what people like or what they're sensitive to. So it's a tricky thing, you know.
Well, of all the books I've read recently, Ghost Mountain is company. You're in the company of all the characters. It's lovely. You want to know what happens to Ursula and Dominic and to Elaine and to Ocho and Ruth and all those people. You want to find out. And there's a curiosity, and they're really well written, really well written. So congratulations. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. That's good to hear.
Yeah. So third book, can we talk just about your day job before we get onto the book? Because I think it's a good context for people when they're listening to somebody to know that they're not just a writer. You're also...
I'm also a civil servant. So I work in the Department of Social Protection. So most of my job involves dealing with aspects of social protection policy. And I've been a civil servant now for over 27 years. So it's part of there's a good tradition actually of Irish civil servants who write, like Flann O'Brien, for example, Thomas Kinsella as well, one of my favourite poets. And also in other countries, one of my favourite novelists is a guy called Naguib Mahfouz, who's the only Arabic winner of the Nobel Prize in literature, and he was a civil servant all his life. I'm not quite aiming that high, but it's it works. They complement each other well. They're both very much involved in the written word and also trying to understand people and trying to understand society are big parts of being a civil servant. So I've found they coexist quite peacefully, actually.
And on a practical level, I suppose, it means that as a writer, you don't have the pressure to deliver a hit, you know, that you know that you're going to be able to put food on the table for your family, even if the novel isn't a hit.
Exactly. So it's kind of liberating, actually, because if I were to look, I have two kids, aged 13 and 15, two boys, and to look at their beautiful little faces, you know, as they weep, looking for Xboxes or whatever, and to say, sorry, daddy's book was a flop. Yeah, there'll be no Xbox for you this year. It kind of gives me freedom. It gives me freedom in terms of who I work with, in terms of publishers, and also in creative choices. I sometimes wonder, like my three books are quite different from each other. And I sometimes wonder if I was entirely reliant on writing to support my family, would I have written Leonard and Hungry Paul part 3 at the moment, just keep doing what had worked the first time? And I could see how that pressure could be quite uncomfortable. Whereas I'm on a small publisher from Yorkshire, and when I'd finished my first book, I'd mentioned I was working on something. And my publisher just emailed me and said, oh, I see you're working on something else. We'd love to publish it. And I said, I also have this kind of idea, half idea for a thing called Ghost Mountain. Right. I'm literally on my lunch break, sent him 2 or 3 lines. And he said, yeah, we'll do that as well.
Give us those 2 or 3 lines there, what you can remember of them.
Well, I said it's about a mountain that appears suddenly and how that plays out into the lives of some ordinary but also slightly strange characters in the community, and how I suppose a person's definition of themselves is changed by a change in their environment.
Yeah, and it's never revealed whether the mountain has some magical power or not. It's never revealed how it happened, and that doesn't matter really.
Yeah, there's a recurring line in the book, which is that Ghost Mountain is Ghost Mountain.
Yeah.
And mountains for thousands of years have been objects of projection. So in spiritual traditions, philosophical traditions, they are seen to have magical qualities. People look on them and immediately they think of timelessness. It makes them feel small. And they've also been thought of as godlike or spiritual in some way. So they receive these projections from people. We constantly look at them and put our own ideas onto what we think the mountain represents. But so in other words, we look at mountains as something intermediate, something that point to something else. Whereas Ghost Mountain is Ghost Mountain. And that's actually quite a hard thing. And even the people in the book struggle. There's a painter in the book and she struggles to paint it because even though a mountain is the most obvious thing in the world, it's very hard to see because you flood your own thoughts about the mountain. You don't see it. And it's very hard for us as humans, I think, to accept the finality of that definition. You know, that Ghost Mountain is Ghost Mountain. We want to turn it into a symbol, a metaphor.
And some characters do. That is magical and they nearly worship it and walk around the bottom of it and all sorts of things. But that's sort of periphery to the lives of these people, ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. What happens is that you have these very different people. And I think at the beginning of the book, they all have their own idea of who they are. One guy is a town drunk. One guy is an acting clerk of MAPS. We have a retired art teacher. We have a young couple. The woman is an old soul married to the guy who's a young soul. And they all have these very defined characteristics. And I think now this is my third book. I can look back over what have I been banging on about for these three books. And I think I'm interested in people in transition, people at that point of change. And so their lives change. And I think we see an awful lot of people when they're letting go of who they used to be, but they aren't yet who they're going to be. And I'm really interested in human nature.
But that's interesting because are we not ultimately the same person? Does the change in our environment, does it not just bring out a different side of us?
Well, I think with the characters, what happens, and I think what happens in life is that we have a version of ourselves that is somewhat visible and somewhat invisible. There are things about ourselves we don't know and that we can't know. And what we do as people is we like to externalize that. So in other words, we project something into the world. There's a certain ray you are inside yourself and a certain ray you are outside yourself. Mm-hmm. And you know that you're in that sort of spectrum, but there's also things you don't see. And in particular in the book, one thing I'm interested in is the influence of absences on people. So we know what people have in their lives, but we also, it's slightly more subtle to understand what they're missing. And so what people do is, I have the sense of who Ronan is. I bring that to the world, hoping the world will give a stamp of approval or recognition. And mostly the world doesn't care. So it leaves us in this sort of half state of uncertainty. And so people kind of carry this around and they act out.
But isn't that liberating that you're at a stage in your life where you've arrived at that conclusion that you know, this facade or this image that you want to portray, that most people don't care because they're too busy doing the same thing themselves. So they're not worried about Ronan Heshen or Ray Darcy or whoever. And that's liberating.
It can be, yeah. If you have that realization, and if you live out of that realization,
it comes with age, Ronan. And I'm always jealous of, and this goes back to the old soul, young soul. I'm always jealous of young people who have that, and some young people do have it. And is that part of the old soul, young soul? That some of the characters, sort of old head on young shoulders.
Exactly. There are some people. And my younger son is like this. He's only 13, but even when he was very young, I got this sort of sense, he's done this before. Yeah. You know, he seems to know or have instincts that he couldn't have learned in his lifetime. So there are some people who seem to go in the flow of life just that bit easier. It's familiar to them. And then there are others who wrestle with life the whole time and are constantly trying to change the world because it's not how they'd wish it to be.
And they're doing it for the first time is the inference, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the lack of familiarity.
Yes,
and I suppose it's the sense that we are part of a wider system, a society, a world, an environment, and we're one part of that. And people sometimes try to force that to be the way they want it to be.
Yeah. Lovely painting on the cover. And that's by?
It's by Tom Clement. He's an Irish artist. I'm very involved, always in the covers for my books. My background is in music, and in music, cover art is really special. You know, like you think the cover, some of the great cover images like Sgt. Pepper's, you know, it's really an important part of the
identity. Nevermind.
Yeah, Nevermind, example. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I'd been looking for about a year at mountain pictures. It's hard to find a good mountain picture, actually. A lot of them, probably because a lot of them evoke the
This has been a father holding down a high-powered civil service job and writing a book. And you're, oh no, the book was delivered, was it?
No, while I was writing it.
All right,
sometimes you get in, once you have the name of the book or a cover image, you kind of work towards that almost.
Okay.
And I had been it's hard, I'd say, hard to find a really good mountain painting because they're all trying to evoke something, you know, philosophical or deep, and you can sort of smell that off them. And then I came across, there's a really good book called Negative Space by Irish art critic Christine Leach. And she writes about Tom Clement's work. He's an Irish artist based in Cork. So I got in touch with my publisher. My usual system is to ring my publisher and say, can I contact this person and can I hustle? So they give me the blessing to hustle. So I contacted Tom, explained who I was. I was a writer, told him about the book and said, would you give us permission to use your beautiful image? And he was really supportive of it. And we've actually got to know each other a bit. And he has an exhibition that just finished in Dublin there last week. And his paintings are marvellous. But he's painted a lot of mountains.
Has he read your book?
I've given it to him. It's been a delicate subject to sort of say, have you read it, Tom? So yeah, I'm assuming it's either, you know, by his bedside or that maybe he has read it. And
I was reading an interview you did and the word theodolite comes up over and over. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Theodolite,
which is a thing for measuring the topography of a landscape. Is that it?
That's right, yeah.
And it comes up over and over again. It's recurring. And you said that you only came upon it as you were writing the book.
Yeah, so one of the things I did, the style of writing is quite different to my previous books and I wanted to write in a more spontaneous way. There are a few different things I did, but one of the things I did was I would always use something from that day.
Right.
So when I sat down to write, and it might be something small, you know, that maybe I had a lemon meringue pie and I might put a lemon in the book and it might just be a passing reference. But whatever reason, when I was first writing about theodolites, I must have seen a theodolite, which are basically, if people have seen them, they might not know what they are, but you see surveyors and
it's like a tripod.
It looks like a camera.
Yeah, on it, yes. And you see a man in a high-vis jacket and sometimes a hard hat looking at it and he's signalling at his mate who's 200 yards away and he's moving one way or another. Is that it?
Exactly. They seem to always be in pairs. I don't know whether theodolites bring about loneliness or whatever it is that they always need to be together. But so I obviously had seen that and I said, okay, well, today I'm putting a theodolite. And because it's a mountain, obviously, the idea...
So which came first, the theodolite or the clerk of maps?
They would have come in around the same time. I probably had seen one person with a theodolite and thought, okay, I have today's idea.
There was a character. I find in books, there's always one word where the writer's going, I'm going to show off here, right? And your word is vituperative.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Vituperative. I've never come across it before. I had to look it up.
Okay, yeah. Well, vituperative is about cursing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's probably, yeah, now that you mention it, I probably am guilty there. Unconsciously, I'd say. It's probably a kind of Penguin Classics kind of word where they weren't allowed curse. They probably say people would make vituperative remarks.
So, right, vituperative remarks. Yeah, V-I-T-U-P-E-R-A-T-I-V-E. Yeah, which is a lovely word. Declarative and vituperative. Side by side, those two words were.
Yeah, my editor is normally...
Takes those words out.
Yeah, she will certainly make me fight for them. My editor is Lynn Webb. She's in her mid-70s. She used to be a professional wrestler in the era of the era of Big Daddy and Giant Haystacks. Her name was Judy Starr. She was a female professional wrestler.
That's brilliant. So, there's a book in horror.
Oh, her life would be amazing. Yeah. So we were really good friends now over the course of the books. And she would normally... the great thing about the way it works with my publisher is that I've complete creative freedom but editorial challenge. So in other words, you can do what you like, but it better be good. And so sometimes my editor will say things, very gentle phrases like, not up to your usual standard, a little comment box, or we'll ask, you know, is this meant to be a joke? In which case I'll say, well obviously it's not working as a joke. So she'd normally call me out.
That's a great one. Is this meant to be funny?
So obviously those two slipped through, but she must have felt that they worked for the character.
You were talking about absence earlier on, and there's a good bit of loss, as in people die in the book. And you talk, I've never heard this description of grief before, but you talk about grief as being similar to homesickness.
Yeah.
Now, where does that come from? Because I know you lost your dad when you were young enough, and you lost your mum how recently?
That's 2007.
Right, okay.
So I lost my dad in 1983. Actually, the book was launched on Thursday, which was the anniversary of his, the 23rd of May, the anniversary of his death. So yeah, so I'm at a stage now where, you know, in my life, I've, you know, lost my parents, you know, we've lost friends, family members and so on. So I have unfortunately, grief is part of life. And my experience of it is, yes, homesickness, I would say. In other words, there's almost that you can't get back to the place you were. And the impossibility of revisiting that, time prevents it. So you never fully regain who you were, but you do kind of grow around it. That does become part of you. And, you know, the absences, I think there's a reference in the book to a woman, you know, her one loss is omni-absent, you know, the opposite of omnipresent, you know, where it's just everywhere you look, you feel the absence. So, but it is part of life. And the more I think about things, and I already think about them too much, when we talk about, you can kind of look at these stories as lots of individual lives, or you can kind of look at it as life with a capital L. And it's kind of rearranging itself, reconfiguring itself, in the same way that the beads in a kaleidoscope are rearranging themselves in patterns. So over your life or my life, we only experience it once, so we can't see the pattern. But if you have lots of characters and over time, you see some of that repetition is about establishing patterns. So you can see that life is reconstituting itself, reworking itself the whole time.
Yeah, like there are types of people. You know what I mean? Like I remember I did psychology and I think there's 7 personality types or something like that. So there's a recurrence of that. And when you meet somebody, if you're in their company for any amount of time, you can sort of pigeonhole them. And usually you're right. Sometimes you're not. Okay. Is that what you're saying, that in society, the same types of people come up over and over again? Is that it?
Well, or you can look at it that it's just one thing, which is life. And it's reorganizing itself into different patterns. It's representing itself. An analogy would be when you're looking at the beach, you're seeing waves and waves and waves and they each look different. But actually, it's just the same water reorganizing itself. So it's in order to write about that, you need to have the passage of time. So you can't just write about one life and track it all the way. You need to see different people coming and going. And of course, the constant there is the reader. So the reader as the observer and all that.
And does it 3 generations? How many years does it cover?
It probably covers about 25 years.
Thereabouts.
So yeah, it starts out with the people who are around at the time of the mountain appearing. Uh-huh. And then subsequent generations. And so, but you get some feedback through the generations where different things occur.
It was high risk, wasn't it? You know, like having a mountain appear. It was like, you just don't know how it's going to pan out, do you?
Yeah. Like, I think, but I'm up for risks. You know, I'm up, I feel I'm involved. I was involved in music before, so I'm probably about just over 30 years on the go as a sort of creative head, right? And I think the most dangerous thing is cruise control. You know, you make something work once and you say, this is good.
Yeah.
And you go for it again and it doesn't have the juice because it's not spontaneous. So there has to be some jeopardy. Like, I think there was a bigger risk really with my second book, which is like to come back. What's the worst thing you could do after a book that does well is do a book with a footballer in it? You know, which is, you know, in the
book. I've read your second book. I've read your first and your second.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I kind of, I think it's very important.
Panenka,
that's right, yeah. So I think your first 2 or 3 books, and who knows how many books I have in me, but I think it's good to widen the neck of the bottle a little, to do different things so that people don't get the idea that, oh, I know what he does. I'll buy one of those books. I know what they are. Each one has to be a fresh idea and you need to take those risks.
Well, it's great. Highly recommended from here. Ghost Mountain, Ronan Hessian. There's 2 photos in there and you recognise it from the brilliant painting by
Tom Clement
on the cover. Ronan, thanks so much for coming in and good luck with the book. Congratulations again.
Thanks for having me, Ray.